From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. concerns about possible Russian incursions in Ukraine, the search for that missing Malaysian passenger plane, African asylum seekers in limbo at an Israeli detention center, plus are Nigeria's neighbors a safe haven for Boko Haram? Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. What's happening in Ukraine dominated talks at the nuclear summit in the Netherlands on Tuesday, and President Obama, who attended that meeting, said that he is concerned that Russia may be poised to move farther into Ukraine. He warned such a decision would bring further economic sanctions on Moscow. VOA's Luis Ramirez reporting now from The Hague.
President Obama's warning came at the end of a nuclear summit where the Ukraine crisis overshadowed discussions about preventing nuclear terrorism. At a press conference after the summit, Mr. Obama told reporters he is concerned about reports that Russia is massing troops along the Ukrainian border. He said those troops have a right to be on their own soil, but warned they should go no further. Russia is showing no signs of pulling its forces from Ukraine's Crimea region, and Ukrainian troops have withdrawn from installations there. President Obama said he does not believe the world's recognition of Crimea as a part of Russia is a done deal, but indicated it is clear that Moscow has taken over.
Obviously, the facts on the ground are that the Russian military controls Crimea. There are a number of individuals inside of Crimea that are supportive of that process. There's no expectation that they will be dislodged by force.
Using military force to remove Russia is not an option that Mr. Obama and U.S. partners have discussed here. President Obama has instead concentrated on sending Russia the message that further action against Ukraine or any other nation in the region will result in more costs in the form of tougher sanctions.
You know, I think it would be dishonest to suggest that there's a simple solution to resolving what has already taken place in Crimea.
There were a number of meetings on the sidelines in which President Obama worked to isolate Russia for its moves to annex Crimea. Among his successes, an emergency gathering he called of the G7 leaders of industrialized democracies ended with a group suspending Russia and canceling a meeting that had been scheduled in the Russian Black Sea resort of Sochi. The meeting will now be held in June without Russia in Brussels. That is where President Obama headed late Tuesday for meetings with EU and NATO officials. At NATO, Mr. Obama will reassure allies of U.S. support and urge members to provide assistance to Ukraine's government. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, The Hague.
And now to Kiev, where VOA's Steve Herman reports that the first president of Ukraine, in an exclusive interview with VOA, has warned that if Russia invades the mainland of Ukraine, it could be the start of World War III.
The man who served as independent Ukraine's first leader is warning that war will spread far beyond his country if Russian troops move across the border. Leonid Kravchuk, speaking with VOA News in the Ukrainian capital, says he still hopes international pressure can prevent further aggression after Russia took control of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Kravchuk says Russian President Vladimir Putin will not be satisfied only with Ukraine. That will not be the stopping point, and this can be the beginning of the Third World War. While Russia denies plans for further military action in Ukraine, it has moved troops to the border between the two countries for what Moscow says are exercises. Some Ukrainians and security analysts have expressed concern that Russia might try to take control of parts of Ukraine or nearby Moldova, where there are sizable ethnic Russian populations. Some people here and abroad have questioned that if Kravchuk, as president 2 decades ago, had not agreed to send to Russia the 1,800 nuclear warheads it inherited after the breakup of the Soviet Union, Ukraine would not now be facing a possible war with its former ally. Kravchuk says he has stood for and still stands for nuclear weapons not existing at all. And that is why he signed the 1994 agreement in Moscow with then-Russian President Boris Yeltsin and U.S. President Bill Clinton to remove all nuclear weapons from Ukraine. In exchange for relinquishing what at the time was the world's third-largest nuclear arsenal, Ukraine, in the subsequent Budapest Memorandum, received guarantees of its sovereignty from both Russia and Western powers. Russia's annexation of Crimea, following a flash referendum amid political turmoil here in Kiev, violates that agreement according to the U.S. and the European Union. Kravchuk, president from 1991 to 1994, is calling for the West to impose tougher sanctions because of Russia's actions and the military threat it poses. Otherwise, he says, Russia could cross the line and the consequences will be dangerous not only for Ukraine, but also for the world. Kravchuk, a top Communist Party official in Ukraine until the dissolution of the Soviet Union, has especially bitter words to describe President Putin, whom he remembers as a KGB officer who carried the briefcase of others.
Putin працював в службі безпеки, КГБ.
Він... Kravchuk says Putin absorbed the worst methods of the KGB, which, he contends, was responsible for repression and everything else atrocious that happened in the Soviet Union. Kravchuk says the world should remember that Mr. Putin was raised in the organization. Kravchuk, now honorary chairman of Ukraine's Friendship Association with China, says he understands Beijing's abstention on the UN Security Council vote declaring the pro-Russian referendum in Crimea as invalid. He says China's decision not to cast a veto alongside Russia, its traditional ally, was actually a small victory for Ukraine. Kravchuk notes China shares a long border with Russia and desires to get along with a neighbor who is becoming increasingly aggressive, a situation, he says, with which Ukrainians can certainly empathize. Steve Herman, VOA News, Kyiv.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Calmer seas returned today, and the search for the remains of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 resumed in the remote parts of the Indian Ocean off the western coast of Australia. Gale force winds that forced an all-day delay on Tuesday died down, allowing a total of 12 planes and two ships from the U.S., China, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand to take up the hunt for any pieces of the plane, which went missing on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8th with 239 people aboard. On Tuesday, angry relatives gathered in the streets of Beijing complaining about Malaysia's declaration that that plane went down with all aboard. The rage and frustration of mothers, fathers, daughters, and sons was quite evident as they rallied outside the Malaysian embassy. VOA's Belaid was at the protest.
In a rare public show of defiance, dozens of angry relatives demanded Malaysia tell them the whole truth about what happened to the flight and said they would not give up until they saw their loved ones again. Walking through Beijing's new embassy district, they shouted, "Malaysia lies. Give us back our loved ones."
They're hiding information. Everything they say turns out to be false. Nothing is true or correct, and that's why we're here.
Protests are rare in China, especially in the country's capital. But authorities allowed it to go on, apparently out of sympathy for the passengers' families. The Chinese government is also calling for the truth. It has demanded Malaysia turn over all satellite information used in Monday's determination that the plane most likely crashed in the southern Indian Ocean. Police originally planned to bus relatives quietly to the doorstep of the Malaysian embassy, but in the end, families refused and walked from Lido Hotel, where they have been staying, to Malaysia's representative office. Onlookers reacted with curiosity as the families marched through Beijing's city streets. The rally was peaceful, although emotions ran high. Protesters shouted, "Malaysia is worse than dogs or pigs." Later, one man calls for the Chinese government to come forward, but is quickly told by others to not say that. It was clear from the start that the march was highly organized, with relatives wearing matching shirts and carrying pre-printed placards. But many had more to say. Some wrote messages on their shirts. This woman wrote one character in Chinese, "hate." As the march began to attract crowds, police angrily kept onlookers away. Reporters were forced to remain behind police tape at angles that made it difficult to film straight-on shots of the rally like this one. Despite the protests of family members, Malaysia Airlines says it is doing all it can. But when asked Tuesday whether he should resign, the company CEO says that's a decision for later. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Also in the news, the leader of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood and almost 700 members of that group went on trial Tuesday on charges including murder and inciting violence. Came a day after the mass death sentences for more than 500 members of the Brotherhood. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
In Egypt, another day, another trial. On Tuesday, Mohamed Badia, the Muslim Brotherhood spiritual guide here during his arrest last year, is one of nearly 700 Brotherhood supporters charged with murder and sabotage. The trial, at which many defendants, including Badia, did not appear, is in the same Minya region court that Monday sentenced more than 500 others to death. That verdict for the death of one policeman and other violence, rendered on the second day of the trial, unleashed condemnation locally, internationally, even from anti-Brotherhood members of Egypt's judiciary.
We believe the trial's fairness, which is a right enshrined in the criminal code, was absent in the case, and therefore we take this stand, not in favor of any party. We are all aware and in agreement about the crimes committed by the Muslim Brotherhood. However, we must defend the rule of law in Egypt and ensure justice for all.
In Cairo, where support remains strong for the crackdown against supporters of ousted president and Brotherhood figure Mohamed Morsi, many were pleased with the decision.
This is good because it is the first time we see our judges act so quickly, because this was the second session.
But such swift action against Morsi supporters, compared to the dragged-out cases of pre-revolutionary officials, left others angry.
So why hasn't Mubarak been given the death penalty? Why hasn't al-Adli been given the death penalty?
With the mass trials and harsh sentences handed down to Morsi supporters being called the revenge of Egypt's military-backed leaders, worries of a greater backlash grow. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Israeli Supreme Court is due to begin hearings next month on a controversial law that has allowed the government to detain thousands of African migrants who are seeking political asylum. The migrants, mostly from Sudan and Eritrea, say they fled repression in their home countries, but the Israeli government says they are merely looking for work. VOA's Scott Bob visited the detention center in Holot near Israel's border with Egypt and has our report.
Late morning at Holot. Residents are passing the time outside. Among them, Nuruddin Ismail. He fled his home in Darfur, Sudan, 10 years ago after government troops destroyed his village and arrested him. He was 16.
They targeted me as I belong to the rebels. Okay, I arrested two times. That's why I can't live in normal life like anyone else, and I left my country.
Ismail spent 4 years in Chad and Libya before crossing Egypt's Sinai Desert into Israel. Many refugees have been killed trying to cross. Israel allows those who make it to stay while they apply for political asylum. More than 50,000 migrants have arrived in Israel in the past 7 years, causing resentment among some Israelis. The government wants them to leave, says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We are also determined to remove from here those who succeeded in entering before we closed the border. I want to make it clear, these are not refugees. We are talking about illegal workers infiltrating, and we are determined to bring them to justice.
The number of residents at Holot, now 1,200, has doubled each month since the facility opened 4 months ago. Visitors and the media are not allowed. Residents may leave during the day, but they must report back 3 times during the course of the day, says Emmanuel Abraha, who fled Eritrea 5 years ago after deserting from the army.
Holot is not a prison, but it's certainly not an open facility. There is no trial, but there's no hope you'll be released. It feels like life imprisonment.
The Israeli government has offered the migrants $3,500 and a free ticket if they leave. Ismail says if he goes back to Sudan, he will be suspected of being an Israeli spy.
Yeah, in this question, I only have two choices. Or I stay here forever, or I go back to my country and get killed.
The residents can visit Beersheba, 1 hour away, but they must be back by nightfall or face time in the prison across the road. The government says more than 2,000 migrants have accepted the return offer, but many have turned it down. They say their only hope is asylum, although they know only a handful have received it. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Holot, Southern Israel.
As the Nigerian military battles Boko Haram in the northeast, its government says that militants are finding safe havens in neighboring countries and then mounting cross-border attacks into Nigeria. Nigeria's neighbors are faced with a difficult question. How do they crack down on this trend without also making themselves targets of attack? VOA's Ann Look is following the story.
Northeastern Nigeria borders Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. It's a long, porous border stretching more than 500 kilometers. The border is difficult to secure, something Boko Haram is believed to have taken advantage of for years. Niger and Cameroon are of particular concern. In Niger, the regional capital, Difa, is just across the border from Nigeria's Borno State, the epicenter of the insurgency. The prefect of the Difa region, Anusa Sauna, says the town is on the front line. He says Boko Haram is a constant threat. For now, he says they have not been able to carry out operations in Niger. But he says there is a lot of cross-border movement of people, given how close they are, and given the fact that communities on both sides of the border share languages, ethnicities, and even familial ties. In February, Niger's military said authorities arrested 20 Nigerian Boko Haram militants, allegedly plotting attacks on Difa. In Cameroon, there is concern that Boko Haram has camps in the hilly border areas and could be recruiting. Hamunde Mohoman is the imam of a mosque in the Cameroonian town of Kolofata, on the border with Nigeria. He says Boko Haram recruits there. He says they come and meet traditional chiefs and go through them to recruit. He says there are young people there doing absolutely nothing, and Boko Haram takes advantage of that. He says they come and take them to train them. He says they use them to bring them food, money, and other things. He says the government is saying nothing. Nigeria has closed part of its border with Cameroon, saying militants were using it as a way to sneak back into Nigeria to carry out attacks. The Cameroonians have ramped up their border patrols and security since last year. Nigeria has called on them to do more. Analysts say it's a question of resources, and Nigeria's neighbors don't necessarily have the money or the manpower to put towards something some still see as a Nigeria problem. Boko Haram has mounted very few operations outside Nigeria. Boko Haram has carried out two separate kidnappings of Westerners in Cameroon, but the militants have otherwise left that country alone. That could change if Cameroon takes a more aggressive stance. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
New report from Human Rights Watch says Ethiopia is using some of the world's most advanced surveillance software to monitor communications between Ethiopians at home and abroad. Marta Vanderwolf reporting now from Addis Ababa.
Human Rights Watch says that the Ethiopian government is spying on its citizens and monitoring the activities of Ethiopians in the diaspora by using high-tech software from China, Italy, and Germany. Felix Horn is the Horn of Africa researcher with the International Human Rights Organization. He says the Ethiopian government has unlimited access to records of phone calls and emails of Ethiopians at home and abroad.
Inside of Ethiopia, its control of its Chinese developed telecom system results in it having unfettered access to the phone records, you know, to the metadata of all phone calls in the country. Outside of the country, they're using Western-made technologies to target the activities of very specific members of the diaspora. These technologies are being provided by a company in Italy called Hacking Team and a company in Germany called Gamma.
Ethiopia's telecommunication is monopolized by the state-owned Ethio Telecom. A SIM card can only be obtained in Ethiopia after registering personal details, making it easy for the government to identify domestic callers, according to Human Rights Watch. A U.S. citizen of Ethiopian origin filed a lawsuit against the Ethiopian government last month, saying his computer had been hacked and he had been spied on for more than 4 months. Horn says that certain ethnic groups feel particularly at risk when answering phone calls from abroad.
One of the things that we found in our research is that individuals that receive phone calls from abroad are often targeted and accused of talking to banned organizations or of plotting something against government, despite there being very little evidence to that effect.
Getachew Reda, an advisor to Ethiopia's prime minister, denies the Human Rights Watch report. He says the group has made it a habit to accuse Ethiopia of almost everything that goes wrong in the region, and it has a negative knee-jerk reaction about any developments in the country. He adds that the government would not waste resources in eavesdropping conversation of opposition figures and that the accusations are pure hogwash. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether the owners of private companies should be allowed to use deeply held religious beliefs against abortion to avoid a government mandate to provide health insurance for their workers that includes contraceptives. The High Court took up the issue on Tuesday. Don Wharton is a pro-choice advocate who was demonstrating in front of the Supreme Court.
Certainly a corporation per se has no religious beliefs, and it is just absolute and complete bigotry to imagine that they would have the right to propagate their religious views on health care to anyone else.
And Jean Ann Maxson is the vice president of Americans United for Life.
Well, we believe that real health care should respect life, and what this case is really about is forcing business owners who have sincerely held beliefs that life begins at conception to fund abortion-causing drugs against their will. And that's against the American dream. It's against all the principles of freedom of conscience and freedom of liberty and freedom of religion that we hold so dearly in this country.
The case before the Supreme Court involves two companies, a chain of hobby stores and a furniture maker. Their owners claim the government's edict that workers' insurance includes some types of birth control would violate their religious views. In the United States, the freedom to practice one's religion is guaranteed by the country's constitution, but the question in dispute here is whether that guarantee extends to corporations, not just individuals. President Obama said Tuesday he intends to ask Congress to end the bulk collection of Americans' phone records. Instead, the government would ask telephone companies to search their records for possible links to terrorism. Details of the government's secret phone records collection program were disclosed last year by the former National Security Agency analyst Edward Snowden, who's now in exile in Russia. Those favoring privacy were outraged to learn that the government was collecting phone records and holding them for up to 5 years. Mr. Obama promised to make changes to the program in an effort to win back public support. Well, U.S. stock markets got a lift on Tuesday after some time of being down. The S&P 500 rose 0.4%, ending the day at 1865. Dow Jones Industrial gained 0.6% to 16,367. And the NASDAQ composite was ahead 0.2% at 4,234. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On March 26, 1169, the military and political leader known as Saladin gave up wine drinking and frivolity to become the Emir of Egypt. Saladin founded a dynasty that ruled much of the Middle East during the 12th and 13th centuries. On this day in 1812, an earthquake destroyed most of the city of Caracas, Venezuela, killing some 20,000 inhabitants. In 1827, one of music's greatest composers, Ludwig van Beethoven, died. An accomplished violin and piano player, as well as a conductor, Beethoven composed chamber music, two masses, an opera, and nine symphonies. In 1830, the Book of Mormon was first published in Palmyra, New York. The book is considered scriptural by the Utah-based Church of the Latter-day Saints. In 1872, one of the strongest earthquakes in U.S. history, measuring about 7.8 on the Richter scale, heavily damaged the Central California community of Lone Pine, killing nearly 30 residents. Two major American literary figures have birthdays today. American poet Robert Frost was born in 1874. On this day in 1911, American playwright Tennessee Williams was born. In 1917, the first of three battles was fought between Allied forces and German-led Turkish troops in and around the Palestinian city of Gaza. After pushing the Turks out of the Sinai Peninsula, the British would not be victorious in Palestine until later in the year when they captured Jerusalem. In 1953, Dr. Jonas Salk announced a vaccine to prevent the paralyzing virus known as polio. In 1971, Bangladesh, formerly East Pakistan, declared its independence from Pakistan. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Two human rights activists recently arrested by Sri Lankan authorities have been released. Father Praveen Mahasan, a Catholic priest and director of the Center for Peace and Reconciliation, and Ruki Fernando of the Inform Human Rights Documentation Center were detained March 16th. Police said they were arrested for trying to create communal disharmony. Both men had been working with families of individuals who had disappeared during the decades-long civil war between the government and separatist Tamil Tigers. The war ended in 2009 with the defeat of the Tamil Tigers. The Sri Lankan government has been accused of responsibility for the deaths of large numbers of civilians in the final months of the conflict and for not taking adequate steps to ensure reconciliation, justice, and accountability since the war ended. The recent arrests were widely condemned by human rights monitors and governments, including the United States, which issued a statement saying, "It is disturbing that the government of Sri Lanka has taken punitive measures against its own brave citizens, who have devoted their careers and lives to investigating alleged human rights abuses by both sides during Sri Lanka's long and brutal civil conflict. These detentions and the continued harassment of those who support the quest for reconciliation and accountability send a chilling effect across Sri Lanka's vibrant civil society and undermine Sri Lanka's proud democratic traditions." In its latest human rights report on Sri Lanka, the U.S. State Department noted several major human rights problems, including attacks on and harassment of civil society activists, journalists, and persons viewed as sympathizers of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam terrorist organization by individuals allegedly tied to the government, involuntary disappearances, and a lack of accountability for thousands who disappeared in previous years, and widespread impunity for a broad range of human rights abuses. The United Nations Human Rights Council is currently considering a draft resolution sponsored by the United States and other countries calling for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to lead an investigation into rights violations in Sri Lanka. In its recent statement over the detention of Sri Lankan human rights defenders, the U.S. Embassy said, "Both previous and ongoing human rights concerns have led many in the international community to push for a UN Human Rights Council resolution on the situation in Sri Lanka. With these latest actions, we remain convinced that continued scrutiny by the Human Rights Council is necessary."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.